Don't like the position, but it means the convention's drawing to an end much too soon. But we look forward to next year, and perhaps next year we'll have 2 days. First of all, I'd like to bring the love and greetings of the brethren in West Palm Beach. The Pearsons, the Grables, and Sister Kay all wanted to be here very much. Sister Kay, particularly talking to her a number of times over the past couple of days, has expressed that over again. We have some others, but we'll wait until the testimony meeting to bring that. Our lesson today is Thou Shalt Be Clean. And we are going to be looking at the fifth chapter of 2 Kings. Now, there's a lot of talk that has gone on, not today, but amongst the brethren, about Elijah and Elisha. And we're going to be dealing a little with Elisha, but he's kind of a secondary part in the story. But to set this is well after the time that he has departed and recrossed. And he is now working restitution miracles of numerous kinds and has developed quite some reputation for that. We're going to kind of give you reprint references here as we break down various different parts rather than trying to give isolated thoughts and reference each one. So basically there are four articles that pretty much follow this story. And they are reprint 2346, reprint 3438, 4768, and 5780. Elisha, by this point, had been known in Israel for some time and developed this reputation. And this reputation was carried into Syria by a maidservant of Naaman. She served in his household as a maid to his wife. And Naaman was the principal Syrian general of his time. This maidservant was a captured Israelite. The Lord seems to have had more interest in Syria than other nations in the area. Partially, we think, because that Israel had conquered it and it was considered a part of Israel during a portion of David's reign and all of Solomon's reign. Consequently, there was considerable influence on the part of Israel within Syria. Traditions and heritages and things like that. So the God of Israel was not unknown to the Syrians. In fact, Elijah, preceding Elisha, was sent by God to anoint Hazael as king of Syria at one point in time. It is possible, Brother Ezra tells us, that this maid may not have known Elisha's name or even where in Israel he resided. But she did know of his reputation. And so she approached probably Naaman's wife and told her of this man who might be able to cure Naaman, for Naaman was a leper. Despite all his power and his might, despite all his nobility and his position, nonetheless, he was a leper. Upon hearing of this, and certainly anyone in this condition, you would think, would grasp for any remote straw that they would find. He went to his king, told him of this situation, and asked how the king might be able to intervene in his behalf. The king was very amenable to this and sent a letter to the king of Israel, outlining the fact that this was a trusted servant and he was sending him to Israel to be cured. Well, Jehoram, who was the king at this time, received the letter and immediately rent his clothes because leprosy was incurable. So to his mind, there was only one possible motive for this letter and this situation, and that was to provoke an attack upon Israel for failing to be able to cure this man. But indeed, that was not the case, and this was part of God's plan, because while the king was in agony over this, and he had good cause because, among other things, he happened to be an idolater. So God apparently revealed to Elisha the situation, and Elisha sent a message to Jehoram and told him that send him to me. What makes this particular ironic is the fact that Naaman had apparently appeared or was about to appear at the court and assumed the fact that obviously so great a healer, so great a prophet of God would naturally be at the court of the king. And Jehoram was totally ignorant of Elisha. So he had been in real trouble. Naaman was not an unappreciative individual. In fact, he determined that what he was asking was quite a bit. And he had assembled a gift that was rather considerable for the day. 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of raiment or expensive clothes. Brother Russell's comment on this was it was equivalent to something on the order of about $77,000 in his day. Some of the other more modern things put this in the, something in the order of, in this particular Bible, $3.8 million in today's parlance, so it would be considered a very expensive gift. But considering what he was asking, he thought it was a fair bargain. Naaman and his entourage arrived and was instructed by Jehoram, thankfully was able to wash his hands and put the responsibility elsewhere, so they went to Elisha's. And they arrived at, instead of finding a great mansion or a lot of pomp and circumstance surrounding this man, a rather humble home. So Naaman hailed Elisha, announcing his presence, although it was already known to Elisha that he would be appearing. However, he was vastly disappointed because Elisha didn't come out. In fact, he didn't even acknowledge him other than sending a very direct message through his servant. That message forms our text. It's from the 10th verse of the chapter. And the direction was, go and wash in Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come clean again, and shall come again to thee, and thou shalt be clean. Very direct statement, nothing complicated here. And when we remember the Jordan River, though, we're going to see a slight different tack being taken here, because the Jordan River, for all that we tend to think of Israel, in reality, most of the places is a rather small stream, and it's usually pretty muddy, and it is not at all attractive. Well, Naaman was angry. In fact, incensed would be probably a better word. He was insulted, for he was not a common man. Men bowed before him. They jumped when he commanded. And it wasn't exactly that he expected Elisha to bow before him or anything like that, but he thought at least he'd come out and say hello. After all, he had bought these costly presents. And of course, we recognize that, yes, they were in fact costly. He came with great expectation, and in his eyes, he'd been treated like a dog. That Elisha thought him not worthy to even be met, but instead to send his servant. And then, to top it all off, he's instructed to wash in the Jordan, this muddy river. His home, Damascus, was known for some beautiful streams, known for their crystal clear waters, for their great beauty. And likewise, we see that many advanced theories of salvation that are contrary to the real salvation of our Lord. Theories that appear beautiful or pretty on the surface. But when looking upon our Lord and his sacrifice, they view it as being too bloody. Kind of rhymes with muddy, so it fits. In other words, God's approach to the answer is unattractive to them. Yes, Naaman had journeyed numerous days only to come to be insulted, or at least in his eyes. He did not recognize that the lesson here was that there was to be no difference in this arrangement between kings and beggars when approaching God. In fact, Brother Russell points out, it is difficult for the wealthy and the powerful to learn to be humble. Of course, one of the reasons he couldn't appreciate this lesson was the fact that the Redeemer was still quite a ways off. And so, from his standpoint, there really wasn't a lesson to learn. The lesson is for ourselves. We find that good men do tend to attract good people to their service. How often we've heard about a boss who is particularly good, or a football player who inspires the rest of his team, or whatever else, and how good he makes everybody else. And despite the initial things we've learned about Naaman, he was indeed a good man. God himself had given Naaman a victory over Israel. Naaman had with him companions and servants who apparently thought a great deal of him. They understood his resentment. They could see how it appeared to be an insult. But apparently some considered that Elisha was not representing himself in the matter, but instead was representing God. And therefore, this sense of aloofness, or apparent aloofness, might well be proper in his position. They argued that, well, you expected to give a gift. You expected it to be expensive and costly. You were prepared for this difficult task. And instead, what was asked was relatively easy. It's not difficult. So rejoice that this is easy. Why don't you try it? Brother Russell tells us that good counsel is indeed needed by both the wise and the foolish. And though wise, Naaman's judgment in the matter indeed was clouded. It reminds us of two scriptures in Proverbs. Proverbs 12:15. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he that hearkeneth unto counsel is wise. And no matter how wise any of us are, at times we all are foolish, and so was the case here with Naaman. A companion to this is in the 13th chapter, verse 10. Only by pride cometh contention, but with the well-advised is wisdom. And so fortunately for Naaman, he was well-advised. Another argument along this line was the Jordan River lay in their path on the way home. Why not try it? What could you lose? And here we begin to see a little bit more of the character of Naaman, for he indeed humbled himself, and he entered into the river. We can imagine some of his thoughts in doing this. This was a proud man, had some faith, but his faith was really hanging on some words of a maidservant. We imagine he may have thought, am I a fool in doing this? Will I be healed? You know, what happens if this doesn't work and I go home and, you know, what will people think of me? Yes, his pride indeed needed to be humbled to do this simple task. But more important than his pride, he desired a blessing. And he had apparently persistent faith. He dipped in the water as instructed one time, two times, finally a third, and still no change took place. He was as before. Again, he continued in a fourth and a fifth and a sixth time, and still absolutely no change. Now, we might imagine he might have thought, well, it's going to be a gradual change. You know, so by the fifth or the sixth time, we ought to see something. Still nothing. So he bathed the seventh time. And upon bathing the seventh time, he arose, not only healed, but also restored. His skin was like a child. And the lesson here is, that to be restored from the sick and sin of leprosy, in his case, which is of course a type of the sin of the world, it does take complete full immersion, full baptism into our Lord. For without it, if we hesitate even a little, we won't attain it. There are many with moral leprosy that think they can rid themselves of it on their own. Some hold back, some lack faith. But in order to be clean, you must exercise that faith. It reminds us of Romans 12 and 1. It is not the sinner who is ready to accept this proposition, but it is the repentant sinner that is in the heart attitude to do this. You can imagine his rejoicing and his thankfulness. Yes, he indeed received this blessing, but only as a result of his exercising a faith. In this case, not a faith that had been proven and tested, but the faith of desiring the blessing and the word of a bondmaid. We are told that in Luke 4:27 that there were many lepers in Israel, but only Naaman the Syrian was cleansed in the time of Elisha. Now, many men at this point would have been healed and thought nothing of it and thought, I got out of this cheaply, didn't cost me anything. I assembled all this wealth and he didn't ask for any of it. Humbled myself a little, got this wonderful blessing, let's continue on home. But no, another point of Naaman was showed by the fact that he went back some 40 miles journey to Elisha to show his gratitude. It showed the nobility of his soul and the fact that he acknowledged that the healing was of God and not of man. We come to the second little piece of dialogue here. It's in the 15th verse. He and all his company had returned and stood before Elisha, apparently now meeting for the first time. And he declared unto him, Behold, now I know there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now therefore I pray thee, take a blessing of thy servant. But as he said, and this is Elisha, As the Lord liveth, before whom I stand, I receive none. And he, Naaman, urged him to take it, but he, Elisha, refused. And so we see that Elisha turned this gift aside, showing a noble spirit in Elisha. I mean, many men would be tempted. We see all too many so-called religious people who not only would be tempted, but actively seek this kind of wealth. But in this case, he pointed out that the truth is not for sale. And so likewise, we're told that if we are in the position of Elisha, and we have the opportunity to bring blessings to others, we should make it clear that there is no way that we are selling what we have. Financially, from the point of esteem, from any standpoint like that, we are not doing it for gain. Naaman went another step farther as we go into the rest of this chronicle, in that he took back or requested 2 loads of earth to take back, so that he might worship on holy ground. He was having to return to Syria, but he wanted to make sure that when he worshiped the God which he now recognized, he did it on holy ground. And we see what a wonderful attitude this was. In fact, all too often we should consider what ground we are standing on. Where are we assembling? How are we behaving? Do we have the same kind of attitude that Naaman does, or did? Let us make sure that the ground that we stand on is indeed holy ground. In addition to that, it should remind us that when we assemble together, it is holy ground. And we should have the same kind of respect, both one for another and for the meeting place itself. In fact, one point, and this is a side issue that just happened to think about, is that Brother Russell brings out at one point that we should, in essence, worship or reverence our brethren. Not that we put them up as special in and of themselves, but because they are fellow body members. Naaman went one step farther beyond this. He recognized he had a special position. He was of the leadership of Syria. He was responsible with the king of Syria to accompany him frequently to worship their god, which I believe his name was Raman, or Raman, something similar to that. And he was concerned, Rimmon, R-I-M-M-O-N. And he was concerned of the fact that now he would still have to accompany the king, but was worried about the fact that he wouldn't acknowledge or worship this god, but he still had to go there. And would the God of Israel take offense? And basically the response of Elisha was, go, and not to worry about it. That seems to be a strange point, but we'll get back to it a little bit later. That covers the majority of our story here. I'm going to take a look at it a little bit more and do what makes it so significant. As we said, leprosy is indeed a terrible disease. We don't see too much of it here. There are some cases in the United States. I think they number in the hundreds, maybe at the moment, maybe more than that. But certainly is not common, although it does appear in Florida from time to time, and Texas, and yes, California. Those are the three places that in the United States, and I think sort of the Southwest too, so we haven't gotten Arizona. So if you're in a northern climate, you're sort of safe. Anyway, Brother Russell says that obviously we recognize that this is a picture of sin. This is widely recognized among religious people in general. But he gives us five particular reasons for why it is so representative of it. First of all, it is incurable, or we'll get back to that later. It was in Brother Russell's day. Secondly, it is a loathsome disease. It is something that people instinctively shrink away from someone who has it. Three, it can be contagious, so it spreads. Fourth, it is destructive. Five, and this is the one that you would think would be surprising, is it is painless, by and large. Now, painless seems to be kind of strange in all this, but if you stop to think about it, those who are most immersed in sin notice it the least. It is those who are the cleanest, figuratively, who notice it the most. We also happen to think about, in reading about the disease, that there's another interesting point on it. Brother Russell doesn't mention it, but it fits the profile, and that is the more you are around it, the more likely you are to get it. And in addition to that, we find that children are the most susceptible. So the idea of being infected with sin early on is quite common, although it is not a congenital disease. A child separated at birth from parents who have it will almost never get it. It is by being in close contact over a long period of time that it seems to develop. It also causes a condition of separateness. In fact, for years, the treatment was isolation. So separateness and alienation accompany this. Also, interestingly, this disease was one that the determination whether someone was clean or unclean was not made by a physician, but was instead made by the priest. And so likewise, we see the leprosy of sin, the antitypical leprosy, also will be pronounced cleansed only by the antitypical priesthood. The nation of Israel had a remarkable medical background. And numerous places, but specifically the books in Leviticus, go into a great deal of detail regarding health situations. The 13th and the 14th chapters of Leviticus deal exclusively with leprosy. Now, we have come to the point that leprosy today means one particular type of disease. There's two forms of it we're going to get into in a minute. But the leprosy of the Bible had to do with a lot of different kinds of skin infections. It was kind of a lump sum category. And there are a great deal of detail, particularly in the 13th chapter, of different forms of it. Some that affect the head, some that affect the scalp, some that affect other areas of the body. But it was prescribed certain treatments along this line. And the basic treatment was to put somebody away. In the 13th chapter, we're going to look at a couple of verses very quickly here. The 6th, which points out that this period of isolation, as soon as they recognized somebody had a boil or whatever coming up, that they would immediately separate them for a period of time to see what would happen with it. And interestingly enough, the inspection was to take place on the 7th day. So the 6th verse says, "And the priest shall look upon him again on the 7th day, after being separated for 6 now. And behold, if the plague be somewhat dark, and the plague spread not in the skin, the priest shall pronounce him clean. But if it is a scab, he shall wash his clothes and be clean." It is but a scab. He shall wash his clothes and be clean. So the idea is here, there was a separation here for a period of time, the 6 days. And then on the 7th would come the inspection to see what had developed. And if the sign was that the problem had not spread and was not a growing concern, then he would be pronounced clean. Now, however, there would be leftover problems from this, perhaps a deformity or something like that. And what they would do is, if a leper was unclean, they would go through this process again, and they were supposed to be inspected then at 7-day intervals. Down to the 13th verse. "Then the priest shall consider, and behold, if the leprosy have covered his flesh," in other words, if he is totally covered with leprosy, "he shall pronounce him clean, he that hath the plague. It is turned all white, he is considered clean." Now, clean in this case just meant he was no longer contagious. It didn't mean he didn't have the disease, but he was not in a contagious stage. And so likewise, we recognize that if we are covered, if we are white, we are not in a contagious situation. Okay, we want to then move down to the 45th verse. And this is kind of an interesting point, and it leads us to another thing we'll be covering in a few minutes. And that is that if the leper in whom the plague is, his clothes shall be rent, so you can tell him by his clothes, his head would be bare, uncovered, he shall not put a covering upon his upper lip, apparently no mustache, and shall cry, "Unclean, unclean." So the idea was he was to warn others that he was in this condition. Of course, the problem with the leper of today, that he who is immersed in sin usually is not too aware of the fact of his condition. Now, in the 14th chapter, subheading here says the cleansing of the people. And we're going to take a look at the 9th, the 10th, and the 11th verses, kind of in highlight. It begins by saying, "But it shall be on the 7th day that he shall shave all his hair, the hair off of his head, and his beard and his eyebrows. Even all the hair he shall shave off, and he shall wash his clothes, and he shall wash his flesh in the water, and he shall be clean," or considered clean. Again, we have this 7th day picture, and of course we all immediately translate that to the mediatorial phase of the kingdom. "And on the 8th day he would take 2 lambs without blemish, a ewe lamb of the first year without blemish, 3/10 deals of flour for meat offering mingled with oil, a log of oil." And in other words, he was going to make an offering at this point. In fact, 4 different offerings. But the key is the 11th verse. and the priest shall make him clean, or declare him clean, this is as a result of the inspection, and shall present, in other words, the priest will present the man that is to be made clean, these things before the Lord on the eighth day. And so likewise, at the beginning of the eighth day, mankind will be presented before the Lord. And when we say Lord there, we mean God. Is that clear? All right, we've taken a biblical look at this. We're now going to look at it from the so-called scientific community, what their view of this disease is. From the Encyclopedia Americana, we were looking around for this, and we had read years ago that there was a cure developed in 1874. For leprosy. Well, it turns out it wasn't quite a cure. But what it was that in 1874, a Norwegian by the name of Gerhard Hansen isolated the bacillus that is behind leprosy. We were then able to begin to deal with it. And they found some things that helped relieve it. And by the 1940s, they have developed drugs that just about cure it, or actually do provide a cure for it. Except for the fact, they said, in the 1980s, they're seeing a new outbreak of it, and it is not being affected by the drugs the way it has in the past, and they seem to be having problems again. And so perhaps it may be the Lord's way of indicating the fact that as we get down, again, we've got more corruption, but the 1874 date is so nicely marked for us, of showing the turn of the disease at God's direction. In fact, leprosy is also known as Hansen's disease. It is characterized, according to Britannica, by lesions of the skin and superficial nerves. It may also involve the eyes, the testes, the mucous membranes of the nose, and the pharynx. The destruction of peripheral nerves by the bacillus leads to loss of sensation, which, together with progressive tissue degeneration, may result in the extremities becoming deformed and eroded. Almost sounds like a doctor there, but anyway, two principal types of leprosy are the lepromatous, which is the cutaneous type and is marked by widespread infiltration of the grainy masses of the chronically inflamed tissue under the skin. So what it really is it's inflammation under the skin that then sometimes erupts outward. And in the mucous membranes of the upper respiratory tract, the face, the testes, and untreated, the progress is poor. The tuberculoid type has stain-like lesions that are raised reddish borders and patches which become insensitive to physical stimulus as they spread. Now, the thing that becomes interesting is when you understand a little bit more about the disease, you will see why it is so typical of sin. It says that the tuberculoid type begins with a firm, dry spot in which there is no sense of heat, no sense of cold, no sense of touch. In other words, the senses are deadened. And so likewise, we see that's another characteristic of sin. The cellular reaction continues to spread into the main trunk of the involved nerve. So the idea is it surrounds nerve endings and strangles it, so that the impulses cannot get up or down, and thereby causes the loss of power in the muscles of the area, the loss of sense of pain, and the loss of circulation to the affected part. So the lifeblood needed to feed it is cut off, and the nerve is cut off, so you can't feel anything there. It says the most common scene of this is in the forearm and the lower leg, leading to claw hands and gross deformities of the foot, but also paralysis of muscles of the face, the eyes, the neck may also occur. And in the olden days, it was not uncommon to see people with noses that had been eroded away. I mean, basically what we're talking about here is gangrene set in. Very crippled up hands, loss of fingers, toes, foot, all sorts of things. It is a terrible, terrible disease for somebody to go through, and one that usually is not fatal. People with leprosy live for a long period of time with it. We want to very briefly take a look here at some other instances in the scriptures of leprosy because it is found frequently. Most of the time in the quote-unquote white form, which was non-contagious, which was Naaman's affliction. If you notice, he was mingled with general society. In Numbers, the 12th chapter, we have an instance here where Miriam, the sister of Moses, received a dose of leprosy that was inflicted as a punishment, which is not uncommon. And this we find in... Oh, wait. What did we get? The leprosy articles, I don't think we gave you those, where Brother Russell goes into some points on that. 5308, 4576, 2727, and 4769. So those four is where he has some comments pertaining to the disease itself. Okay, now we move on to Miriam. And we find the article dealing primarily with her is in reprint 5307, and then she's also mentioned briefly in 3439. Her principal problem was she was jealous, and she had jealousy because of Moses' Gentile wife, up until the point of Moses' wife rejoining them after they had been out in the wilderness for a period of time. She no longer was the first lady, we'll call it, of the nation. Up until that time, she more or less occupied that position because Moses' wife wasn't there. Also, she was a prophetess of some note, used by God, and she felt slighted. So she tried eventually to undermine Moses and enlisted Aaron in the project. However, the Lord was very familiar with what was going on and called Moses, Aaron, and Miriam to the tabernacle. And then he explained to them that while he dealt with the latter two, Miriam and Aaron, he dealt with Moses on a much higher plane. And for her conspiracy, Miriam was punished with leprosy. She instantly became a leper. However, Moses prayed, and she was healed. However, she was instructed to go to, or that she had to go through the healing process, the exile of the 7 days, and then go before the priest to be inspected. So she was to reside 7 days outside of the camp, showing a full and complete period of test to make sure that the leprosy was gone. Brother Russell's comment, jealousy is amongst the most deceptive of sins, and it is based on selfishness. Our second stop on these notable lepers is Uzziah, U-Z-Z-I-A-H, also known in the scriptures, double named, as Azariah, A-Z-A-R-I-A-H. And reprint article dealing with him is in 4786. And the main accounting on him will be found in 2 Chronicles chapter 26. Uzziah, or Azariah, was considered a good king of Judah. He was reverential. He was blessed of the Lord. He mightily defended the nation. And because of his general attitude, God blessed him. And so consequently, as all too often happens when we study the kings of Israel, his fame spread, and he began to become prideful and heady. In fact, he got to the point that he felt God was proud of him. In fact, he then developed this a little farther and realized, or thought he realized, that he was really above the priest, and that God would actually appreciate him to make a direct sacrifice in the temple to God without using the priest. And the priest, of course, intervened and tried to dissuade him from doing that, but he was insistent and immediately became smitten with leprosy for presumption and pride. Now this lesson is a little different in the fact that Uzziah's leprosy was of the contagious kind, and so he was sequestered and kept away and had to live in a special house the rest of his life. The lesson, of course, here is that he that humbleth himself shall be exalted, and he that exalteth himself shall be abased. Luke 14 and 11. Brother Russell's lesson on this is that humility is important, and that the other fruits and the graces of the Spirit cannot be developed without humility. Our third stop involves our Lord. It's from Luke 17, verses 11 through 19, and reprint 27, 22, and also mentioned in reprint 34, 39. This was the instance where 10 lepers were on the roadside near our Lord and called out to him for mercy. He had been recognized by this group, and they asked for what the Lord understood to be a healing. And so the Lord responded by the command, "Show yourselves to the priest," indicating that they were to go before the priest for inspection, showing that the leprosy was no longer in its active stage. Well, what happened here was that on their way to the priest, they found out that not only had this ceased, but they actually had been healed from it and been restored to their full condition. While their quote-unquote faith brought more than was expected, only one of the 10 paused to go back and thank the Lord. And this one was a Samaritan. And we know it's kind of the interesting parallel here between the one Samaritan there and the Syrian leper who was healed in the case of Naaman, while the Israelites apparently did not exercise that faith. Brother Russell goes on to say regarding this instance that though none were denied or lost their blessing because they didn't render thanks, he said he did not think that any came into the church, but that they did have good hope for the Samaritan after AD 36. We find that he tells us, though, that Naaman was more noble than the 9, more so even than the 10th, who thanked but offered no gifts, and goes on, more important, that it is how these gifts are rendered as to how they are received. Looking back on Naaman, we find that his name means pleasantness. And regarding his character, Brother Russell tells us that Naaman had the spirit, the disposition, and the mind which, under favorable conditions of the gospel age, would have made him a saint. He just didn't live at the right particular moment. However, he does say that he expects that Naaman will make rapid progress in the kingdom. There are a number of things that testify to the character of this man that explain Brother Russell's comments. First of all, the maid who cared. It showed, first of all, that he was a good master, that he was considerate, that the maid didn't rejoice in seeing him suffer, even though she was a captive. Secondly, the presents that he prepared showed a consecrated attitude, desirous of giving a blessing in order to receive a blessing. And the test that he went up against, would he withhold these gifts once he found out he didn't really have to offer them up? He was also tested in reaction to Elisha's instruction. It takes grace and humility to accept slights, and while he didn't exhibit it right away, he rapidly turned around. Brother Russell also gives us a lesson in regards to this, and that is that we should not act like Elisha, that even though in this particular instance, apparently Elisha did the right thing by not showing himself, that is not our position, and that we should do everything we can to help those who are seeking help. Another point of his character is his ability to reason. He was wise. Again, his anger overtook him for a moment, but it showed he was approachable. He would accept counsel even from humble servants. And so we should be aware of counsel given to us. When one of the brethren approaches us gives us a piece of advice, and particularly when it's a piece of advice or a comment that we may not be too happy to hear, don't think of it as coming from that individual. Think of it as coming from the Lord. And like Naaman, sit on it, think about it for a while, and when you've cooled down, you will probably find out that that advice was very good. We find he exercised humility by going through the instructions, first of all, and second of all, when he realized that he had been graced of God, that he quickly recognized the Heavenly Father and decided to serve him. We see he showed a great deal of gratitude, not only in the gift, but the fact that as soon as he was cured, he turned around and retraced his journey, the 40 miles, back to Elisha. No easy task in those days. His generosity. Brother Russell points out that if he appreciated so heartily his physical cleansing, how much more he will appreciate the moral cleansing, the reconciliation to God, when that eventually comes to him in the mediatorial phase of the kingdom. He also points out that noble minds don't seek to get as much as possible. They desire to and give as little as possible. They desire to give a gift. The truly great take pleasure in being generous well beyond justice. He also had a determination to serve. It shows a conscientiousness in contrast to many who have had privileges and have heard of God. And of course, this is a lesson we can well take today. How many have grown up in the truth and really do not serve it? His desire to worship sacred soil, of course, again, leads us to that call, come out of her, my people, to stay on consecrated ground. We do recognize that he was a Gentile, just like Cornelius in Acts 10. He will have to wait his turn. And this explains the fact that his concern about worshiping alongside his king upon his return to Syria and was told not to worry. The reason is because his time had not yet come. Naaman recognized God, but God as yet did not recognize Naaman. So it was inconsequential, the fact that he would be in a temple of a foreign god. And lastly, his faith marked him apart from men of his time. He was different from lepers of Israel. Many had undoubtedly heard of Elisha's abilities, but he was the one who came. And it again reminds us of the fact that without faith it is impossible to please God. Now we're just about at the end, but the story hasn't quite come to a conclusion. But we have one other element in this to bring about. And that is the story of Gehazi. Gehazi's name means Valley of Vision. And he was the servant of Elisha. He was the one that had to go out and face this mighty general Naaman and tell him, in essence, my master has a message for you, but he's not coming out to talk. But Gehazi had quite a history behind him because he'd been with Elisha for some time. He had witnessed many of the miracles. In fact, in the preceding chapter, which deals with the Shunammite widow's son and his death, and Elisha indeed was the one to resuscitate him upon his death, the initial way that was done was the woman came to Elisha and he sent Gehazi back with his staff and told him to place the staff on his chest and he would resuscitate. So Gehazi had seen quite a bit. He knew that God had used Elisha to restore life. He knew, indeed, Elisha was a servant of God. And apparently, up to this point, he had been a faithful servant. However, apparently his heart was not in the right place. It was really unmoved by all of this. And it reminds us of the fact that if a good man departs from his ways and sin willfully, the past good that he has done and his deeds will not be remembered. For Gehazi's problem was that he desired some of this treasure that Elisha had turned down. In fact, he was being rather selfish about it. He was covetous. And Brother Russell says that this leads to other sins, such as lying and murder. Well, it didn't take him too long to make the change here, because he ran after Naaman as soon as Naaman was out of sight and approached him and said that his master would take nothing for himself, but he would like a little of what was offered for the school of the prophets. So he asked for 1 talent of silver and 2 garments. And apparently he thought that this would set him up. Probably would have. And if you think about the financial aspect of this, so that he could go out and live like a prince. But not only was he greedy in doing this, but he made another fatal mistake, and that was that he misrepresented his master. He misrepresented not only his master, but he also misrepresented the character of God. And this can be taken from our lesson of a week ago for our manna article for the week of being ambassadors for Christ. How careful we must be not to misrepresent. Consequently, he was given what he asked for. Not quite. Actually, he was given twice what he asked for. Instead of 1 talent of silver, Naaman gave him 2. Again, showing Naaman's character of his generosity and thankfulness. Gehazi took his loot, carefully went back and hid it. But he didn't hide it from God. And upon his return to Elisha, after hiding this treasure, Elisha approached him and asked him about it. He got 1 other gift. Leprosy. Naaman's leprosy was given to him. Brother Russell tells us that some who have been cleaned and renewed turn back to the leprosy of sin. Others are ignorant to it or are mightily attracted. And again, that brings us back to the idea of the thought of this week's manna article of worshiping the God who is unknown, worshiping in ignorance. Except this is the reverse picture of that. Brother Russell points out that while Gehazi here was a type of the second death class, neither Naaman nor Gehazi had their eternal interest changed or settled one way or the other. They merely had, in the one case, restored health, and in the other case, lost health. To end, we particularly like this thought. Let us not take the grace of God in vain. Let us not be hardened by it. Let us not become esteemed as willful sinners, but let us instead, like Naaman, be appreciative, be thankful, freely acknowledge where our blessings have come from, and be fully consecrated and immersed into his baptism. May the Lord add his blessings.
Thank you, Brother Craig, for that wonderful study in leprosy. It'll give us something to think about when we go back and look at the scriptures. Now we'll see it better and understand it better and look at it more deeply. It means a lot to us. The world is full of it out there, and we appreciate that very much, Brother Craig. Our closing hymn is 246. 246.